the sign of the Virgin and the proclamation of the Son who was child who was born, the Son who's given, and the indication of Emmanuel in anticipation of the kingdom that ultimately would come to pass, which is where things are headed. But many interim things have to be dealt with in the meanwhile. So this is a problem of misplaced trust. And then the next section we start is with chapter 13 through 35 indicate the folly of trusting nations rather than Yahweh. And it's going to be giving indictments against these nations and indicating that God is over these nations. So why are you wanting to look to them when you should be trusting me anyway? And then we'll see that chapters 36 to 39 show how Hezekiah trusted Yahweh and experienced deliverance. So it gives you a little bit of a picture of how things sort of fit together in terms of where we are headed and to try to get your head wrapped around what is involved with this book. And then we'll be looking at some of the details. So that's a little bit of the broader scope of what is involved here. Then the overarching theme of chapters 1 through 39 is judgment for faulty trust. And if you think about the book of Isaiah, you need to remember that it has been referred to as the Bible in miniature because the first 39 chapters are associated with the Old Testament in terms of it has 39 books. And it has a theme that's focused on judgment, and particularly for the matter of faulty trust. And then the next section, what we'll not deal with today, is really focused on the salvation, you know, Yahweh's salvation idea and the provision that's there, though there's an intermixture of things, but that's the overarching theme, starting with chapter 40 going on through 66. So this emphasis on judgment for faulty trust includes Israel's failure to obey the covenant. It includes Ahaz's failure to trust Yahweh, but rather trusting in Assyria. It includes communicating the extent of Yahweh's influence, because often people in ancient times, and perhaps even today to some degree, think of a nation having its territorial god, and that's the extent of it. It's just, this is a given people, they have their god, there's another people, they have their god, and so on. But this is saying, no, that may be the pagan mindset, but that's not reality, because God is over all of these people. He is the true God. Everyone else is focused on idols and idolatry, and the real God is in control of everything. Don't miss that point. And so he is not simply the God of Israel. As that covenant maker with them, he is that, but he's more than that. He's the sovereign over all of the nations of the earth, and he will manifest his reign through the Messiah in the kingdom to come in the future, and that is going to be referenced from time to time, and that's part of the picture that we want to see. And so what this means then is that all nations, all peoples are accountable to him. It's not just Israel. It is Israel. Israel as in the larger picture of all the Jewish people. And the nations that are not mentioned are not exempt, because there's a number of them that are specifically mentioned, and they are often representative of other nations. And so we should take note, because there are nations of today, for instance, that aren't mentioned. Does that mean they're exempt, that they aren't under God's rule, God's authority? No, they very much are. So there's a sense in which these nations that are referenced are representative, relating to past, present, future. And so all nations that exist have had the knowledge of God, though they suppress it. And if we think back to the time of Noah, when Noah got off the boat, how many people at that time knew the Lord? How many of that people at that time were believers? All of them. Everybody was a believer. And then what happened? Things degenerated over time. So did every people group at their inception know the Lord? Yes, they did. Did they retain that knowledge? Not necessarily. And Romans 1, 18 to 21, in particular, Paul references and says that what may be known of him is evident. They should recognize it, and they are without excuse. And that picture is communicated. So there is historical basis for that understanding as well. Now, as we begin this section, the city of Babylon is the focus of judgment. It is the first people that has a pronouncement against it. And if you remember, Babylon goes back all the way to Genesis chapter 11, where it's first referred to as Babel, the Hebrew. The Greek name is Babylon and means gate of God or the gods. And it flourished and declined at various times in ancient history. It would come up in power, and then it would go down over the process of time throughout this time frame. And so it had its low points and its high points. But later in Isaiah's ministry, Babylonian would grow to prominence. And after Isaiah is gone, Babylon is going to be prominent and will become an empire, not just this city. It will become an empire in the time frame after Assyria's fall, but will have an impact in Assyria's fall. And Babylon would also become a serious threat to Israel's existence, as we are well aware. And that is part of what is in view when Isaiah is making his pronouncements now. Even though Babylon really isn't a big deal in view of God's picture of things, of what's coming up, it was very much in the picture and part of the equation that needs to be dealt with. And so this city is now the focus of coming judgment in anticipation of what is to come in the future. And all of this was to be an encouragement to the people in Isaiah's time to take heart, to listen to the words that God was communicating through Isaiah, and to obey, get back to the covenant, and repent of their sin. That was the emphasis. So the basic message that's here is that Babylon is going down because of the disposition that Babylon had, and that's what we want to look at next. Here is a warning about the hazard of self-exalting pride. And it starts off very simply, verse 1, the burden against Babylon, which Isaiah the prophet, or Isaiah the son of Amos, saw. And so we need to think about, what does this mean? So we want to think about in relation to Babylon. We want to look at it from the perspective of, this is the other side of being the object of God's attention. Now, there are many who want to get God's attention, and we usually want to get God's attention because we want something. And so we'll do whatever we can to sort of get his attention, kind of the picture of Elijah and the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel when they were, the prophets of Baal in particular, were jumping around and cutting themselves and all of this to try to get their God's attention to do something for them. But this is another attention that God is going to have with regard to these people of Babylon. And so the term burden means oracle or message from God. The reference, or the recurrence rather, of the Hebrew word masah, translated oracle or burden, means that there is a prescribing of boundaries. That is, it recurs several times in these chapters. And so it's kind of giving you some markers in the text. And there are 10 oracles beginning in chapter 13:1, And then 14:28, 15:1, chapter 17:1, chapter 19:1, chapter 21:1, verse 11, verse 13, chapter 22:1, and chapter 23:1. And you'll see that there are all these references that indicate a recurring theme, a picture. These are particular messages. And so chapters 13 through 23 present the nations over which the Emmanuel, who was referenced earlier, is going to be the ruler. And this is announcing judgment on them for their pride. And that's going to be the recurring issue as well. So these oracles are announcing the doom on these nations. And so they're saying something about these people, but they're also in the process announcing salvation or encouragement for Israel, if she will trust in Yahweh, in God, rather than in these other people. And it's really putting these nations in their place in relation to Yahweh. That's the idea that's here. And that should be an encouragement to Israel, because these messages are not delivered to these nations. These messages are delivered to Israel. So when Isaiah is delivering these messages with regard to the doom of the nations around them, the Israelites could say, well, why are you telling us this? It has to do with them. But it was to encourage them and to show them that God is over these nations. And these nations who are caught up in their own pride and self-exaltation are going to be dealt with and judged accordingly. And so this again was communicating something of Yahweh's sovereignty over these nations and encouraging all of them, including Israel, to rely on the Lord and not to rely on other people and other things. And again, the unifying theme is the pride of these nations that comes up over and over again. And the lesson for us is that we do not fall into the same self-exalting pride and failure to submit to God, as we are encouraged to trust Him and live for Him, because otherwise it's self-defeating to do so. Then the emphasis is that God will hold every nation accountable for its actions. This series of judgment oracles against the various nations sets the stage for a vision of worldwide judgment that ushers in the Lord's kingdom on the earth. And that's part of the picture that's communicated here. There is a now and later emphasis, those things that are relating to them in the near future and then in the far future. And he's giving them a strong picture of what God is going to do in the far future to note the seriousness of who they are dealing with. And if everyone is going to be accountable to him in the future in a big way, and we're talking about the tribulation period prior to the establishment of the kingdom, that's largely what's in view, because we're going to be talking about the day of the Lord. They need to be aware of that. And then that puts in perspective the things that they're going to be dealing with in the more immediate future. So the oracles that are given in this section probably have a twofold purpose. On the one hand, they're for the leaders, those leaders who insisted on getting involved in international politics. Does that still happen today? Still a lot of that going on. These oracles were a reminder that Judah need not fear these foreign nations, because God is over them and He is with Judah. So why should they be afraid? But we have the same problem. Aren't we afraid of those things that are out there, those peoples that are out there, the nations that are out there? And we sometimes forget that God is over them. Why should we be afraid of them? If we are under God, if His Spirit indwells us, if we're His children, why should we be afraid? And so we don't need to be like they were, seeking international alliances for various security reasons. And yet that kind of thing continues to go on. but also this was for the righteous remnant within the nation, and that these oracles were to give them some encouragement as a reminder that Israel's God was indeed the sovereign ruler of the world, of the earth, of the universe, and that people can trust him. That's what they needed to be reminded of. This initial reference to Babylon has broader implications. Now, we might have expected at this point in the text that Isaiah would be speaking more against Assyria, because Assyria was the main threat. Back in the previous verses, Assyria was referenced. Why would he now move on to Babylon, who wasn't really a big issue yet? Babylon wasn't a significant power at this time, but was really just a city within the authority range of Assyria. Assyria had power, although Babylon was a little bit of an unwieldy bunch under its authority, and would become more problematic in time. But Babylon, like Israel, wasn't the easiest bunch to keep in line. So Babylon would become a threat. But Babylon is perhaps referenced here because of the symbolism that is noted, as well as what was going to be happening in the future, because Babylon is a well-known symbol of self-exalting pride, dating back again to the Tower of Babel and the attitude that was communicated there. So what Isaiah said about Babylon was applicable to Assyria and to the other nations around and any of the other places that had similar self-exalting attitudes or powers of that time. And then this dual emphasis would be revisited in the book of Revelation. That is, there's a more immediate emphasis and a future emphasis, because we know that the book of Revelation in chapter 17 and 18 deals specifically with a reference to Babylon, and probably also has in view, while some focus on the exact city or people of Babylon, it may be the idea that is communicated there as well, that attitude, that disposition, that mindset that is there, which any one of us can fall into at any time. But again, this is communicating that God knows the future, and that he has things laid out, and he's warning his people what's on his mind, what's going to be happening, so that the nation Israel can be prepared for what's coming, and hopefully change their heart, their attitude, their disposition. So then we come to the larger portions of the text, and we're going to cover some pretty big chunks here in order to get through this text. So Isaiah 13, 2 through 4 says, "Lift up a banner on the high mountain. Raise your voice to them. Wave your hand that they may enter the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones for my anger, those who rejoice in my exultation. The noise of a multitude in the mountains, like that of many people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts musters the army for battle." So that's communicating imagery of preparation for battle, that the Lord is gathering those who are going to put Babylon in its place. And what we'll see is there is a far view, but there's also a nearer view. And so there's more than one occasion where this is going to be realized. Then looking at verses 5 through 7. "They come from a far country, from the end of heaven." And there may be an element that's communicated here of the host of heaven, as in the angelic realm, because we know in the book of Revelation they have a part in that as well, and God has used them in the past, even particularly with Assyria, to put them in their place. the Lord and his weapons of indignation to destroy the whole land. Wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. So God is orchestrating these details. Therefore, all hands will be limp. Every man's heart will melt. Verse 8, and they will be afraid. Pangs and sorrows will take hold of them. They will be in pain as a woman in childbirth. They will be amazed at one another. Their faces will be like flames. Perhaps the idea of disfigurement from fear is the picture there. So what we want to note here is the results of refusing to acknowledge God's sovereignty. What will happen when someone, a nation, a people, don't recognize that God is ultimately in control? Well, he will exercise his sovereignty and show that he is in control. So be careful. What will happen? Well, there's the unleashing of God's forces for judgment. God has the wherewithal, and he is able to connect with any people or forces out there, and he will turn them loose. So this section here is essentially an introduction to the 10 oracles that follow in chapters 13 through 23, as well as being the intro for the first oracle against Babylon. And it explains why God will judge Gentile nations, because basically they refuse to acknowledge Yahweh's sovereignty and instead exalt and glorify themselves. Now just think for a moment of the various nations of the world. Can you think of any nations of the world that have exalted themselves? That have essentially shaken their fist at God and said, we don't need you. We can handle this on our own. Has that ever happened? It does all the time. And this is the same disposition and attitude that's communicated here. And we all remember the story of the building of the Tower of Babel that is part of the background to this city of Babylon. It communicates this disposition. They were called to spread out after the flood. That's what they were told, just as had been given initially. They were to multiply and fill the earth. But what did they say? They said, let's come together and build this tower so that we won't be spread out. Well, who were they shaking their fist at that time? It was basically shaking their fist at God. And they said, let's make a name for ourselves. That still goes on today. And what did God say? I think I'll change your languages so that you can make the name for yourself all you want to, and nobody's going to understand what you're talking about. And then just the next chapter later, God says, Abraham, I'm calling you out, and I'm going to do something new here, and I'm going to make your name great. He says, you do it my way. Otherwise, you're going to be messed up. So that's the attitude and the disposition there. So Isaiah here is relating this message from God, and he's in the process summoning the warriors to assemble, whoever they may be, so that they can carry out his will in judging those people with whom the Lord is angry. And the reference to the raising the flag on the hilltop and calling the warriors to assemble is a picture of God gathering these together in the time frame. And it will be a localized near future kind of thing, as well as a more distant future relating to the time of the tribulation. So both elements need to be kept in mind here, this near and this far view. And so this announcement that Isaiah is communicating here is not good news for those who are under judgment. In this case, it's Babylon in particular. And he's communicating this to Israel, and they should be thinking, well, if Babylon is going to get this, what about us? Do we have the same disposition? Do we have the same attitude? Do we need to have this same message taken to heart for ourselves? And hopefully they were picking up on that, though it didn't seem to be doing so well, and we may not either. The emotional impact of God's judgment is also communicated here, verses 6 through 8. There's a reference to the day of the Lord that has to do with his active intervention in history. Whenever we have reference to the day of the Lord, that's the basic picture. God is going to be intervening in some way. Generally, more often it is in judgment. Sometimes it is also in terms of salvation. And we have seen before the judgment and salvation are always together in some way. And this is recognized as being at hand or close by. And the Hebrew word that's used here has the idea of total preparedness of that day. Is going to be ready without necessarily indicating that it's going to be real soon or imminent, but it is on the horizon. And it would be sufficiently ominous that they should take it to heart, and there's this reference to them wailing. And similarly, in Amos chapter 5, verses 16 and 17, there's this lament of wailing, this lamenting and wailing with regard to the day of the Lord, and that's a similar theme that is communicated in various texts. So it would be a day when the Almighty, the one who is sovereign, who is over all nations, is going to bring destruction because of the refusal to recognize that he is God. And so he's going to put things in place. And again, Israel, Judah, the people of God, God's chosen people, should have been paying attention. They should have seen this pertains to us as well. We better listen here. So then looking at verses 9 ultimately through 16, we'll take them in a couple of chunks. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, for he will destroy its sinners from it. Notice the emphasis on the people and their dispositions. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth. The moon will not cause its light to shine. Now, before pressing on, let's just wait for a moment and think, where have we seen that language before? The sun will be darkened, the moon, stars of heaven will not give their light. Where have we seen that? Well, we're looking from our time frame. We can say, well, we saw that in the book of Revelation. That's referenced there. Saw that in the book of Joel. These promises, prophecies that were made. So what's that telling us? Well, this is indicating, well, some of this very clearly relates to a time future associated with the tribulation period. But we'll also see shortly that there's a more immediate emphasis as well. Let's just focus for a moment on there's a distant time frame that is in view. So then he continues, verse 11, I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud. See, those are those attitudes that are recognized, and lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. Those dispositions that are there, which fortunately we never have, but we've probably seen them on television, right? Or in the mirror. I will make a mortal more rare than fine gold, a man more than the golden wedge of Ophir. Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth will move out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts, in the day of his fierce anger. It shall be as the hunted gazelle and as a sheep that no man takes up. Every man will turn to his own people, and everyone will flee to his own land. Again, the human desolation that is expected. So there's a physical thing with regard to the land, and you think, well, what did the land do? What did the stars in the heavens do? Well, they are affected by the sin of people as well. When we realize that, we realize, wow, we really have an impact for evil because of our own sinfulness. Verses 15 and 16, everyone who is found will be thrust through, and everyone who is captured will fall by the sword. Their children also will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered and their wives ravished. So this is strong language of what kind of thing will be anticipated in the future that this nation will have to deal with. And remember that we're talking about a near anticipation within like 100 years or so, and a far anticipation associated with the tribulation period, which will be even more devastating. Then the eschatological application of judgment on Babylon. Remember, eschatological has to do with the end, things at the end times. It's the future-focused idea. The judgment is focused on the evil attitudes of sinners. That's the emphasis that's here. The coming judgment would desolate the whole earth and would exterminate the sinners from it, especially those who are noted as missing the mark of righteousness that God's expectations are. And this judgment would involve the darkening of the sun, the moon, the stars, many other passages that we have seen. That's also in Matthew 24 when we were going through that passage. So it gives us an idea of what time frame, Zechariah 14, Joel 2, Ezekiel 32, Revelation 8. Now, another observation here is in referencing these particular elements, the sun, moon, and stars, since the pagans worshiped those objects back in that day, and in our day, we might add, people are still worshiping them, maybe in a slightly different way, but nonetheless, they're worshiping them. So it signals a judgment on them in a sense as well as idols that people are focused on. But the reason for the wrathful judgment is because of the evil that people are doing, particularly, again, recognizing the pride and the haughtiness, the refusal to accept God as their sovereign ruler. Boy, you know, when we look at our own nation, we don't have to look very far, and we see there is exactly that same kind of attitude, that same disposition. People are wanting to get out from anything that might be keeping them from exercising their personal autonomy. And we don't want God to be telling us what to do. And that's pretty much the attitude that seems to be communicated. The judgment will harm the physical world and the human population. We see some of the reference there, verses 13 through 16. The heavens and the earth will shake at the fury of Yahweh of armies, often associated with the hosts of heaven, when his anger would burn against the wicked. And it does so, that is, God responds in that way because of his justice and his holiness. It's based on his character and his being consistent with what his character is. And then we have the imagery of the people being scattered like frightened gazelles and sheep in that day. But God's warriors, those that he is sending for judgment, will slay the wicked, and there will be a hazard as it relates to children and houses and women and all the rest. So it's a devastating picture. It's sort of the stuff of worst nightmares is the picture that's communicated here. I mean, just imagine the worst possible thing that could happen. Well, that's the idea. Now, these are the kinds of things that happen in a fallen world too often, but this is going to be where God removes his hand of blessing and he is unleashing the full effects of sin to function. Then a description of the extent of future judgment. Verse 17 says, "Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them who will not regard silver, and as for gold, they will not delight in it." Now we're narrowing the focus less on the broader picture of the far distant future, but more the more immediate future. But here we see that the motivation will not be for monetary gain. That is the motivation on the part of the Medes. And by this time, the Medes were already becoming a formidable source. They were, in a sense, a current dread to the Assyrians. They were recognizing that these people are growing in their force, their abilities, and that they were a force to be reckoned with. And in time, the Medes would unite with the Babylonians to destroy the last vestiges of the Assyrian Empire in 609 BC. And then later, the Medes would join with the Persians, who would overthrow Babylon in 539 BC. It's referenced in Esther 10:2, Daniel 5:30-31, and Daniel 6:8, 12, and 15 for reference. They were seeking political exploitation, not resources. They were one of the instruments of God's judgment. So on the one hand, they were operating by their own choice, what they were thinking in their minds. They were not motivated by greed, but by power and sometimes by revenge. But God is using that, and God is using them. Commentator named Grogan writes, "The Medes are probably mentioned here rather than the Persians, because, even though they will be working together in time, because of their greater ferocity, and also because they were better known to the people of Isaiah's day. According to the Greek historian Xenophon, Cyrus acknowledged that the Medes had served his cause without thought of monetary reward." So there's other documentation to validate this recognition here. Now, a byproduct might be the accumulation of goods over time, but that wasn't what was driving them. It was their own seeking for power in addition to God's directive and moving them in a certain direction. Then verses 18 and 19. "Also, their bows will dash the young men to pieces, and they will have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eye will not spare children. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah." Now, you just kind of need to let that sink in just a little bit. When you think about some of these things here and the attitude that's communicated, the people that are going to be coming and wrecking havoc on Babylon, Babylon, which was known for being a glorious kingdom and lifted up in pride, they are going to be overthrown, and there are going to be casualties in the process. Well, you think about our own world and the attitudes and dispositions that are going on today, and who are the casualties? The children. The individuals who are vulnerable, they end up being the casualties in this kind of a scenario. Unfortunately, the human devastation will be indiscriminate. This section of text foretells the destruction of Babylon, some of the kinds of things that were going to be dealt with there. And this is a judgment that had future implications that would probably be more near, but also probably had more distant implications as well. Because when we look at the immediate, we see that there's going to be the fall of Assyria. Chapter 14 of Isaiah 24 to 27 deals with that. That's one fulfillment. And then the later fall of Babylon, chapter 13, 17 to 22, as we're dealing with here, was another. The extent of human harm would be vast. It would include the young, the vulnerable. Would include those who would have had much future hope, but they will be casualties. And we think about our own world and those who are the casualties of attitudes and dispositions that wreak havoc on one. It's a little disturbing. So the harm done would be extensive as it related to the human population. The breadth of reversal will be great. What we think about here is we have a nation who was lifted high and recognize as different aspects of being part of the seven wonders of the world. In the late 700s, Babylon was the showcase of the ancient world, and particularly shown while it was under the authority of the Assyrians. It was more culturally and economically superior to Assyria at this time, and then was ascending in power politically, though it wasn't quite there yet at the time that Isaiah is communicating this. The Chaldeans were the ruling class who had been responsible for the supremacy of Babylon. But Isaiah is here announcing that Babylon would experience the same fate as Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, how significant was that? How well did they survive? How did Sodom and Gomorrah survive God's attack on them? Nothing. Zip, nada. That's the picture that's communicated here. They would go from a great high to a great low. And what was the problem? Pride, arrogance, and all of that. And that'll be touched on again because it comes up recurringly. Then verses 20 to 22. It will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabian pitch tents there, nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there. But the wild beasts of the desert will lie there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will dwell there, and wild goats will caper there. The hyenas will howl in their citadels, and jackals in their pleasant palaces. Her time is near to come. Her days will not be prolonged. The scope of damage will be extensive and lasting. The formerly bustling city will be uninhabited. There had been a lot going on there. I mean, Babylon was a happening place, but it's going to come to naught. After her judgment, Babylon would be uninhabited even by nomads, and there would be a time when this would take place. Babylon was one of the nations, along with Egypt, to which Judah had looked as a possible savior at times when it was looking for somebody to bail it out of a problem. Instead of trusting in God, they again were looking for somebody else to help them. And we obviously have that same problem. You would think we would learn, and we have these texts to remind us. When we're going through difficulties, our inclination is to find a pill, get help from someone. Trying to remember what they called that call that you make on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where you call somebody and they bail you out. That's the kind of thing that we tend to want to do. But we should go to God first. That's usually our last resort. So for all the things that Babylon was known for, that was going to be taken away. The location would be the dwelling of wild animals. The text is pretty self-explanatory here. But when and how was this prophecy fulfilled? That's a question to wonder. Has the prophecy been fulfilled? We know that Babylon suffered defeat in 689 BC when Assyria, including the Medes, under Sennacherib, devastated it, but the city was rebuilt. Some interpreters believe that the fall of Babylon in 539 BC to Cyrus fulfilled the prophecy, but Cyrus at that time left the city intact. Others believe the destruction that Darius Hystaspes in 518 BC had done, and later Xerxes completed, was the fulfillment. Some scholars believe that what Isaiah predicted here never took place literally, at least completely, so the fulfillment lies in the future. Many conservatives argue for a near and far fulfillment, and we have seen that scenario before. Thomas Constable thinks the destruction in 689 that resulted in Babylon's temporary desolation fulfilled this prophecy. But he also believes that there will be an eschatological judgment of Babylon, though not necessarily one that requires the rebuilding of the city. And there's been a lot written on this, a lot discussed as it pertains to this. Sometimes destruction terminology that appears in passages such as this are more noted generally and hyperbolically as it relates to the destruction and the defeat, but not always fulfilled in the exact detail. And so we don't know exactly if that's the case. So it's maybe just a little bit up in the air as to the nature of the fulfillment, but we do know there will be a far fulfillment when Babylon will be indeed completely dealt with. That's noted in Revelation chapter 17 and 18, and then culminating in chapter 19 when Christ returns. So as we come to this text, there is the idea of the severity of judgment. And the issue is prideful rejection of God and failure to live up to his expectations. And so we're drawn to think, well, does this apply to us? Surely not, because we're such good people. I mean, here we are. We go to church. We read the Bible sometimes. We do what he says. We're obedient, right? Well, we need to take it to heart as well, because sometimes we can have just little bits of self-exaltation that can pull us away and cause us not to rely as much on the Lord as we should. And we remember that we are all without excuse, and we are all sinners. And we do have to deal with our inclinations to be led astray from what God's expectations are. So we don't want to fall in that same, down that same path. But we think about our own nation. How can we keep our nation from going down? Because it's going in the same direction as what Babylon did. Is there anything that we can do? Well, we can certainly pray. We can pray diligently. We can stay true to the Word ourselves. We can communicate what the Word says. We can share Christ. We can recognize that God is who He said He is. And we can do what Scripture reminds us to do and what the song reminds us to do, to trust and obey. That's the emphasis that we need to be reminded of.